imagine 400,000 FSB officers across Russia, including about 200,000 paramilitary units like the border guards. And they, again, their number one mission, John, is keeping Vladimir Putin in power. Nobody is higher in the Russian hierarchy than the intelligence services. Alexander Bortnikov, the head of the FSB, is a general of the Russian army. He is the highest rank in the Russian army, along with Gerasimov. The FSB had a huge role in the planning for the Ukraine operation, both in 2014 and in 2022. The point of that whole exercise was he wanted everybody on the record, on TV, with him in front of the Russian public saying, yeah, we're all for it. We're for the invasion that's happening now in a few days.
Hey, welcome back to the MWI podcast, brought to you with the generous support of the West Point class of 1974. I'm John Amble, and on this episode, I'm joined by Sean Wiswesser. He has nearly 30 years of experience in national security, including as a senior operations officer with the CIA. Specifically relevant to this episode, he has extensive professional experience with Russia's intelligence services. In fact, he recently wrote a book about those services under Vladimir Putin called Tradecraft, Tactics, and Dirty Tricks. In the discussion you're about to hear, Sean explains how Putin has managed to make the intelligence services in Russia personally loyal to him. The conversation then examines the shadowy but often central role Russian intelligence services play in Russian activities around the world, from the war in Ukraine to efforts to gain influence in the Middle East, Africa, and elsewhere, to Russia's information war against the West. It's a really insightful discussion, but before we get to it, as always, just a couple quick notes. First, a very special thank you to the West Point class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. And second, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Sean Wiswesser. Sean, thanks so much for joining me on the MWI podcast.
Well, thank you, John. Honor to be with you and your listeners. Appreciate all the men and women's service that I know are dialing in from your listeners, and glad for the chance to talk about Russian intelligence, something I'm passionate about.
So your name has come across my radar quite a few times recently, and that is because you have a new book that you wrote. It's called Tradecraft, Tactics, and Dirty Tricks. The subtitle is Russian Intelligence and Putin's Secret War. And you've been in, I guess, kind of high demand since it was published. I've heard you interviewed, heard you on podcasts, I've seen your writing. And I think that's because there's an appetite, a desire to sort of better understand not just Russian intelligence, but its role in everything Russia is doing in the world today. That's, you know, particularly Ukraine, but also its involvement in other regions in the world, its covert work against democratic elections, for instance, what have you. And I guess, you know, that's what we're going to talk about today. And specifically, I want to do so through sort of a lens of modern war, modern strategy, and modern statecraft. Before we get to it, I guess sort of by way of introduction, I wonder if you can share with listeners a little bit about your background and how that led naturally to you writing this book.
Yeah, sure, John. So 30 years in foreign service, defense, and intelligence, the vast majority of that I spent 28 years as what we'd say as a staffer, you know. The vast majority of that was with CIA. I was a case officer or operations officer with CIA, retired as a senior officer and as an expert in our directorate of operations. My expertise, I was a senior expert in both Russian intelligence, but also what we call denied area operations. So how we operate in the hardest of environments, places like Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, and we have to operate in those places. As a famous former division chief named Burton Gerber said in the 1980s, CIA can have no denied areas in the world. We have to be able to operate worldwide. So that was my focus and my expertise, and that's why the book is focused on tradecraft, John. It's focused on how the Russians do their craft, everything from traditional espionage, sticks and bricks techniques, as we call them, surveillance, all the way through hybrid war, modern techniques that I touch on heavily at the end of the book. So that's a little bit brief overview about me and about the book.
So listeners will be aware of many of the things that Russia has recently done and is currently still doing in the world. Of course, I'm talking about the war in Ukraine, but also Russian involvement in the Middle East, in Africa or Latin America, Russian influence operations targeting Western democracies, what have you. And I guess, you know, my goal with this episode is for when we get done talking, listeners to have, you know, kind of a clearer picture of Russian intelligence's role in all of that. So, you know, to kick us off, I guess, can you give a sense of what, when we talk about Russian intelligence, what are we talking about? What are the agencies, their remits, maybe, you know, how that compares or contrasts with the U.S. intelligence community as sort of a basis of understanding? I think that will really help kind of frame the discussion.
Yeah, sure. John, by the way, I should state my views are mine alone, don't represent CIA nor any other U.S. government agency. So, but from my decades of experience working this target and with my colleagues at CIA and across the intelligence community, I was honored to have a number of joint duty assignments, including with the military in my career, served in war zones. You know, the Russian intelligence services, this is a whole different type of threat. John, it's one I believe, and I make the case in my book, they're an existential threat, not only to the United States, but to democracies around the world. And I think it's an underappreciated threat. You know, 20 years of war, the United States was engaged heavily in Afghanistan and Iraq. We had to be. I deployed, I'm sure, you know, vast majority of your listeners that were in and out of uniform, deployed in the war zones. We had to. We were attacked. But during that period, Russia was largely getting a pass. You know, if you look, John, at the national security strategies, the unclassified versions, for decades now, Russia was barely top 10. And yet they continued a steady pattern of escalation, what we now are calling hybrid war and gray zone warfare. This is not new to the Russian services. So who are we talking about, and how do those analogies play out between the U.S. intelligence community and the Russians? In short, John, to your question, there are no analogies. There's no equivalence between the role of Russian intelligence and their security services in their society and in the United States. We're a constitutional, law-abiding society. Russia today is not. The Russian intelligence services do whatever the hell they want. They are beholden only to one individual, Vladimir Putin. You know, in the days of the KGB in Soviet times, at least the KGB was the sword and shield of the Communist Party. They were held responsible to the party, and there was no KGB chairman who didn't answer to the Politburo. Nowadays, those checks are not in place, and Putin himself is a former head of the FSB. So these are his attack dogs. They get to do whatever they want. You know, broadly speaking, the three main services I focus on in the book, the FSB, the Federal Security Service in Russia, they are not an equivalent to the FBI. They're a vast bureaucracy, numbering somewhere in the order of probably 400,000 officers. You know, our largest intelligence agency or law enforcement is Customs and Border at about 75,000. So imagine 400,000 FSB officers across Russia, including about 200,000 paramilitary units like the Border Guards. And they, again, their number one mission, John, is keeping Vladimir Putin in power, keeping the regime in power. Everything else comes secondary to that. Counterterrorism, counterintelligence, counter-narcotics, corruption, which is a joke because they're completely corrupt. They lead the corruption in Russia. All those things come secondary to keeping the regime in power. And then you have the GRU, military intelligence, and the SVR, the foreign intelligence services, smaller bureaucracies, but still giant, vast bureaucracies who are deeply embedded within the Russian government and corporate system. Those ruling siloviki, as they're called, John, the men of power, the strong men. And that's their term. That's how they refer to their senior cabinet officials, strong men. These are all KGB hardline veterans who Putin's known since his days in the KGB 30, 40 plus years ago. Not just the security organs, but people like Igor Sechin, who's head of Rosneft, the giant oil corporation in Russia. So they're all deeply embedded with one another. They're all a part of the same giant kleptocracy within Russia. And so there are no analogies to our intelligence services. There's no accountability. In Russia, they're in power and they're going to stay in power as long as Putin's in charge.
And do you have a sense of, I guess, how that relationship unfolded or took shape, just how Putin was able to bring all of those services under his thumb, you know, eliminate any independence, reshape, you know, patterns of subordination and accountability? I tend not to be in the business of applauding Vladimir Putin, but that's not an easy task, particularly doing so, you know, in a period that was still sort of a, you know, free-for-all competition for spoils that we saw in the 1990s. And even after that, where these sort of institutional fiefdoms were, you know, I would imagine perhaps loath to give up their independence.
Yeah, great question. I wrote a piece last week. It was in Foreign Policy Magazine. Hope some of your listeners might check it out. The piece is basically titled "Don't Be Fooled by the Coup Rumors in Moscow." The point of the piece is touching on just what you said. I wrote for Foreign Policy Magazine about how all these claimed potential coups in Moscow, this idea that, oh, he might be weakened by the war, that's complete nonsense. This is a dictator and autocrat, Vladimir Putin, who's been at it for over 25 years now, John. No Russian ruler has ever ruled that country longer, with the exception of two, Catherine the Great, and Joseph Stalin. Okay, Putin came to power, to your point, he came to power as part of a compromise. Yeltsin and his family were worried about their own corruption. They were worried about being held accountable because he was democratic in many ways. He did a lot of great for Russia. So did Gorbachev. But Yeltsin was deeply, deeply corrupt. And so he appointed Putin as head of the FSB, made him temporary prime minister, with the idea that this guy can be controlled by Yeltsin's inner circle. This guy, he didn't look physically imposing, kind of short, you know, easily underestimated, and he was underestimated. So Khodorkovsky, head of Lukoil, Berezovsky, all these oligarchs that had backed Putin, they went along with the bet. They thought, you know what, we're going to control this guy. Well, Vladimir Vladimirovich, he's a lot, as Russians would say, khitreye. He's a lot smarter, a lot more clever than those guys. He's an old Czechist. He's an old follower of the Czechist philosophies, the Cheka, the First Committee for Defense of the Revolution. And it's Felix Dzerzhinsky, Iron Felix, first head of the Cheka, said, you know, we need terror. We need terror after the revolution to enforce our rule on the people. That's Putin's way. He's a believer in that. He makes no illusions he's a Czechist. He's quite proud of it. So what you saw steadily after he came to power with the Chechen War and the after effects of the war, he started instituting terror and repression. And this has continued now. I make the argument, I write for the Cypher Brief also in D.C. I wrote an article this spring, Russia, the Modern Surveillance State, that this is the most powerful surveillance state possibly of all time now. Only rivaled maybe by China today and possibly North Korea. But look at the controls the FSB has in power on the people. No freedom of the press, no democracy whatsoever, no intelligentsia left in Russia. So Putin has complete and absolute power, and he sustained it very well for 25 years. So that's the compromise that was made. That's what people thought is, oh, we'll get somebody that we can control. No. Putin controlled them. Putin very quickly took the reins of power, and now he has complete control of the country.
You know, that's one of the things I mentioned to you when I reached out to you that I wanted to talk about. There have been these reports that Putin has effectively been isolating himself out of fear, really, hiding in bunkers, canceling meetings. I mentioned I wanted to hear your thoughts about the intelligence services in the event of a coup. Would they be protectors of the regime? Could they, you know, be brought onto the side of those maneuvering against Putin? What would have happened in... I'm just trying to count backwards here. So it was 2023, right? When... Yevgeny Prigozhin launched whatever it was he launched. When we had this 24 hours of, you know, will it happen? Won't it happen? What should we have expected if this, you know, I guess column of march that he put together had reached Moscow? You know, what would the intelligence services have been prepared to do? And, you know, could Putin have counted on them?
Yeah, it's a great, John, it's a great, let's return to Prigozhin. Let's look at it as kind of a template of just what's possible in Russia, but also what's not possible. You know, I've written about recently in some of my articles and pieces about this. The Prigozhin mutiny, as it's called, is frequently misunderstood. So Prigozhin, of course, head of the Wagner Group, former cook to Putin, former Yevgeny Prigozhin, former oligarch himself. This was somebody who was deeply trusted by Putin. He was also behind the election meddling in 2016. His internet research agency in St. Petersburg was a bunch of Russian intelligence trolls and proxies that they were using as trolls to meddle in our social media. Again, fundamentally, by the way, I touch on in the book, active measures, not for or against any one individual candidate, but against our whole democracy. Get Americans to distrust democracy. So in addition to that social meddling, he also has his group 30,000 strong Wagner mercenaries used heavily in Ukraine. Well, so when Prigozhin set out for Moscow, when he took his troops off the front line, this was after months of him complaining very vocally about not getting the ammunition and supplies he needed. So when he headed for Moscow, who was he rallying against, shouting, screaming, literally in the Russian news? He famously shouted, Shoigu, Gerasimov, and he used a whole bunch of very vile Russian cussing too, by the way. He's shouting at Shoigu, Minister of Defense, Gerasimov, Chief of the Staff, that his troops are dying at the front, not getting what they needed. So Prigozhin goes through Rostov Military Oblast. I studied as a student once in Rostov. It's where the war's been run out of. It's the southern Russian region closest to Ukraine. And, you know, those Russian generals, John, they were caught completely by surprise. What are they going to do? Fire on fellow Russian troops without direct orders from Moscow? And they didn't have those orders, clearly. I mean, Prigozhin was moving fast, and he's got good equipment. He's got troops that are battle-trained. Now, let's talk about what wasn't going to happen. The reality of it, and Prigozhin knew it, there was no way in hell he was ever going to take Moscow or even try to. He was trying to get accountability. He was trying to get attention. had he gotten to Moscow, he was going to come up against the units of Rosgvardia, hundreds of thousands of fiercely loyal former Ministry of Interior troops that Putin in 2016 took out of the Ministry of Interior and made personally loyal to him. The current head of that, by the name, his name is Zolotov. Zolotov's a former KGB silovik, hardliner with Putin. So that's Rosgvardia. That's the big units, internal troops of ministry. Outnumbering Prigozhin, by the way, 10 to 1. Okay, now beyond Rosgvardia, what do you have? Then you have the FSB elite units of five different special operations elite teams that have killed on Putin's orders, not just in Ukraine. They carry out assassinations, sabotage, wet work. You've got Alpha and Vimpel. Vimpel's famous for taking the presidential palace in Afghanistan, of course. These are fiercely loyal, completely beholden to Putin. So then you got FSB, okay? And we talked about hundreds of thousands of FSB. Now let's talk about the Federal Protective Service, the FSO. You got bodyguards like Krasikov. Krasikov's famous. He's a former FSB officer who became a bodyguard. He went abroad in 2019 and killed that Chechen dissident in Germany and sat 5 years in a German prison until he was released on that swap in 2024 when Putin greeted him on the tarmac airport. Why do I mention that example? He gave Krasikov a bear hug literally on the tarmac, red carpet. That's Putin's way of saying, you kill for me, I'm not going to forget you. I'm going to take care of you. You kill for me, I'm going to get you out. That's the kind of loyalty he engenders, John. He engenders that type of deep loyalty among his innermost ring of security services. So yeah, there wasn't a chance in hell that Prigozhin was ever going to get close to Moscow and really accomplish any type of true mutiny. But he was trying to get attention to his troops. He was fed up. Like a lot of generals, by the way, in Russia, we see hints of this in the Russian blogosphere, discontent with the Russian military leadership. But there was no way he was ever turned over, not turning Putin over, turning over power. Now, did it reveal some real gaps in the system? Of course it did. And what have they done since then in the past couple of years? The FSB's cracked down even harder. Don't forget Surovikin, that senior Russian general, former head of the Russian Air Force, who was rumored initially to side with Prigozhin. Remember him sitting in a room looking dejected on live TV, begging Prigozhin to put down his arms, looking like he was, and he's got thugs standing around him in the room. That was also right out of the dictator's playbook. Hey, don't forget what I'm capable of doing. And let's remember, Putin's killed repeatedly. So Prigozhin was killed. So Putin got the captains of Wagner to swear loyalty, to be incorporated in the military and other units. Prigozhin and his lieutenants were made to look like they would get away with it. And then a few later, months later, their plane falls out of the sky. Again, Putin's been at this a lot longer than anybody gives him credit for. So he knows the old dictator's playbook very well, and he's playing right out of it.
So I want to turn specifically to Ukraine then. And before we talk about the full-scale invasion in 2022 and the major war that has continued since, if we go back to the Maidan protests in Ukraine and their, I guess, psychological effect on Moscow, and then the subsequent interventions in Crimea and the Donbass with Little Green Men and you know, the backing of the so-called separatists, during that period, and really since then, what role have Russia's intelligence services played? Is intelligence driving Putin's decision-making, or is he sort of leveraging it as a tool to frame policy decisions he was always going to make?
I think it's some of both, John. So within Russia, the security services are paramount. This is hard for our military analysts to understand. I routinely read really good analysis of the Ukraine war, but our military experts and analysts, they do it in a vacuum, considering just, well, you know, in our system, the Pentagon's top of the food chain. They get the huge giant budget like nobody else. The generals are calling the shots. Our COCOM commanders call the shots in their theaters. Nobody is higher in the Russian hierarchy than the intelligence services. Alexander Bortnikov, the head of the FSB, is a general of the Russian army. He is the highest rank in the Russian army, along with Gerasimov. Why did Putin do that? Why did he give him that rank, even though Bortnikov didn't spend a day in the Russian military? Putin's made it clear who's calling the shots. I write about in chapter 10 of my book, the FSB had a huge role in the planning for the Ukraine operation, both in 2014 and in 2022. And a big part of it, John, was their historical framing of Ukraine as part of the color revolutions, which they believed were carried out by CIA and the West. See, for the Russians, of course, they can't imagine democratic revolutions. Nobody has a right to free and fair elections. They're too cynical to believe in them. So, of course, what they believe about Maidan and they believe about Ukraine and Kyrgyzstan and Georgia is that, oh, these were carried out by the West against us. And so what you started to see in the 2000s, the early 2000s, and I detail this a lot in my book, I go through the whole chronology. the Russians started talking about what they call non-contact warfare together with new generation warfare. And the idea was written about by generals like Gurdjieff, Slipchenko, Bogdanov, and then later Gerasimov himself. Mark Galliotti coined this term, which I think he knows was wrong, the Gerasimov doctrine, to refer to this. Because even Galliotti later said, nobody in Russia calls it that. But it simply is the very idea that they're going to use hybrid warfare. They're going to use gray zone tactics against the West, which they believed were used against Russia. Wasn't true. We weren't behind those democratic revolutions. So what this meant was, in 2008 in Georgia, control the narrative, information warfare, what the Russians call active measures. Make it look like the Georgians are persecuting the poor people of Abkhazia and Ossetia, and then go send an entire army into Georgia and just take those provinces. It worked, right? It worked. In the West, we did very little. The narrative largely was controlled by the Russians. Fast forward 2014. Poor Russians are being persecuted in the Donbass. We're fed up with this. We can't stand this anymore. Oh, what if there's uprisings in those regions and in Crimea by these little green men, which are, of course, GRU Spetsnaz units and other members of the intelligence services and military elite acting? Did they get away with it? Again, they largely got away with it. So we shouldn't be surprised, fast forwarding again, John, 2022, this time with the Russian intelligence services convincing Putin he could win, specifically the FSB Fifth Service, used to be the Fifth Department. It's their operational analytical department. They're the ones that brief President Putin every single week, wherever he's at, whichever one of his bunkers he's hiding out in, they're the ones that brief the president. And they told him, yeah, this is going to be a short war. We can win this one. We got this. And they were so convinced they got it that the Russian blogosphere, John, if you recall, was reporting very early on in the war about those FSB generals who had picked out apartment complexes in Kiev. They were convinced they would win. So they did have a huge role in prognosticating the war in incorrect, huge failure, huge intelligence failure. They'll never be held accountable for it. But it's also what Putin wanted. So they reinforced each other. His vision was that Ukraine didn't have a right to exist. Putin laid that out in a famous essay, of course, in 2021, saying there is no Ukraine, there never was a Ukraine. And so I think it's mutually reinforcing. You have a dictator that nobody wants to say no to, and then you have intelligence services who are going to carry out his will, going to do his bidding, and they're going to make it happen.
So in 2022, there's this mix of intelligence driving decision-making and intelligence framing to fit, you know, a pre-existing policy decision. Although I think, if I'm understanding you know, correctly, I guess it's probably more of the latter. But ultimately, it sort of doesn't matter because of this dynamic you described. If Putin decides he wants to do something, everybody, intelligence service heads and others, are going to fall in line.
Exactly. And, you know, I try to give folks a flavor. Let me give a flavor for this. It's been written about in some good books. Look at Luke Harding's book, Invasion. Owen Matthews wrote a great book, Overreach. And they give hints of this. They talk about this even from open sources. And I'll tell you again, my opinions are my own. Not referring to anything classified, but from 30 years of sitting across from Russian intelligence officers and debriefing them, John, how do they talk about Putin? They call him the boss. He's chef in Russian. That's how their senior leadership talks about him. He's the boss. The boss gets what the boss wants. It's much like a mafia culture. It's a giant feudal system riddled with corruption. So the boss said in 2021, with a very small circle of advisors, like's written about in those books I just mentioned, very small circle of advisors, he said, we're going to do this. And again, the Russian military, they were implementers. They were not decision makers. And that's hard for us to understand in the United States, where our own, you know, defense sector has a huge, huge say. Secretary of Defense has a huge say, important member of the cabinet. But in Russia, it's the intelligence services calling the shots. So you had Bortnikov, you had Naryshkin as head of the SVR. How do we know that there's truth in this? There was a famous meeting about a few days before the actual invasion, the week before. Putin put everybody on TV, his inner Siloviki. This is a famous meeting, John, where if you remember, everybody was put on the spot. Do you agree with annexing the provinces of eastern Ukraine before they launched the invasion? He didn't talk about the invasion, but he went around the room. And he didn't like SVR Director Naryshkin's answer. And this is where he humiliated him on the air. He said, what's wrong? Basically said, Sergei, speak plainly, Sergei. Basically the equivalent in English of, what's wrong? Cat got your tongue? Come on, speak up. Are you forward or not? And Naryshkin was bumbling through himself. Oh, what I was trying to say, President Putin, is the point of that whole exercise was he wanted everybody on the record, on TV, with him in front of the Russian public saying, yeah, we're all for it. We're for the invasion that's happening now in a few days. And so that's from the old dictator's handbook too. These guys are all in it with him. They're all in bed with him, the consequences, good or bad. So, yeah.
It strikes me that one reason to do that, to get everyone around the table and, you know, get them all to, you know, to agree that Russia should go to war in Ukraine, is that, you know, now you've got a whole group of people to pin the blame on, essentially, if things don't go well. And Ukraine has objectively not gone well for Russia, but Putin hasn't done that. Why is that?
Well, you know, John, this is the lack of any freedom of the press whatsoever in Russia. You know, the past 25 years, he's been so good at, you know, cracking down and clamping down on any freedom of expression or press. So absent any criticism of his government or his regime, you know, what he doesn't really need to hold the services accountable. And as we discussed, you know, previously, these are his Praetorian Guard, you know, these are his attack dogs. So he's going to be very judicious and very careful about holding them accountable because he needs their support. So there's been some little hints here and there. Shoigu, of course, was replaced as Minister of Defense. He wasn't sort of exiled. I think he was as another notional position on the Security Council. And he had been in that role a long time. So, but again, absent any criticism, absent any uprisings, you know, any protests on the streets, which haven't been happening, Putin feels secure, doesn't need to hold anyone accountable.
So if we zoom out from Ukraine a little bit, can you give an example or two, I guess, elsewhere in the world where Russian intelligence services are kind of, you know, kind of the tip of the spear in pursuing Moscow's interests, you know, places that maybe we're not thinking about quite as much?
Yeah, so the developing world for the Russian intelligence services, John, it's always been a battleground. Dr. Christopher Andrew at Cambridge University wrote a series of volumes, three different main books on the KGB and its history. One of them was Vasily Mitrokhin, the famous archivist that defected to the West. I'm honored that Dr. Andrews invited me to Cambridge, where I'll be speaking in 2 weeks to his intelligence seminar there. You know, his book with Vasily Mitrokhin, the title of it's The World Was Going Our Way. It talks about just how successful the KGB was back during the Cold War in the developing world and in Africa in particular. You know, you have regimes that are constantly teetering on the balance of, you know, being overthrown or a coup or imbalance in their governments. In environments like that, the Russians and their information warfare, their historic, what they call active measures, can play a huge role in swaying an election where a few thousand votes here or there may make a big difference. So they've always been active in Africa with information warfare, with election meddling, with recruiting classic agents to manipulate governments and support despots that are favorable to Moscow. Well, now what's changed, though, John, is they're using those private mercenary companies like Wagner, Prigozhin's former company, and they're still active in Africa, not necessarily Wagner, but these other private military security groups all over Africa. There's a statue to Prigozhin, I believe it's in Mali, where he served and his Wagner served for so long, they literally have a giant statue in his honor. And so those Russian mercenaries are still at play in places like Mali, propping up despots, propping up autocratic regimes that are favorable to Moscow.
So I wonder, you know, do these three main intelligence services, either collectively or individually, have any sort of cultural bias for certain types of operations or certain means of conducting them? You mentioned active measures. There's also covert action, traditional espionage, you know, human. Do they embrace or resist new technologies? It's not uncommon for organizations to have these sort of culture-based or history-based preferences. Is that the case with the Russian services?
Yeah, so good question. So in the case of the Internet Research Agency that Prigozhin ran and it meddled in our election in 2016 with the social media meddling, they saw it as an extension of their active measures. So it's not new for them. And this is something for the American people to understand. You know, Russian information warfare goes back 100 years to the Bolshevik Revolution. Lenin was always a big believer. He talked about making use of useful idiots, his term, polezny durak. You know, a useful idiot is someone that, you know, we'll take advantage of their naivete if they believe in the communist revolution so that we can, you know, terrorize the people and institute our revolutionary terror within Russia and the former Soviet Union. So information warfare has always been a steadfast tactic that they've turned to. The use of illegals is another one. Nelegali in Russian, of course, the posing as foreign citizens, Russian intelligence officers posted abroad posing as foreign citizens. Putin believes in it. He doubles down on it, even when they have massive failures, like the ghost stories case in the United States that I had the honor to work on, a detail in the book. Even after that failure in 2010, we knew and all of us understood Putin was going to double down again on illegals, and he has. And then the other traditional tradecraft tactics are, of course, sabotage and other aspects of what we're calling hybrid war is an old tactic for the Russians as well. You know, they call it new generation warfare now is the term they use. But this goes back into the Cold War when they were always active with assassinations of dissidents like Georgi Markov on the London Bridge. So I think these are all tactics they've used for 100 years, John. We just don't have the awareness in the West so much for them. So what we call new is oftentimes old hack for them.
I guess to put a finer point on it, you know, there's a parallel here with the changing character of warfare and war's enduring nature. And intelligence collecting from human sources remains fundamentally important, but might now take place increasingly, you know, online instead of with dead drops and clandestine meetings. You know, active measures still have the same objectives, but might take place more and more on social media and in the cyber domain. Is it your sense that Russian intelligence services have adapted well to those changes? Left something on the table because they remain culturally wedded to a certain traditional tradecraft?
Very good question. So in the West and in the United States, we often have a divide between government and the corporate sector. You may have government contractors. I am one now in retirement myself, but not so in China or in Russia, you know, both of them for that matter. Remember that hacking groups for hire, you know, cyber hacking groups, organized crime groups, they're always going to work for the state. They have no choice. They're extorted and they're told, you work for us or you go to jail. You go to Siberian gulag style prison. So there's no question. They're going to work for the FSB, and the FSB makes active use of, you know, thousands and tens of thousands of hackers and hacking groups across Russia that they extort and tell them, okay, you can hack for profit. You can hack those credit card companies if you want, but you're going to hack for us, for the state too. So this has led to the seamless incorporation of cognitive warfare too for the intelligence services. John, what was done by the Internet Research Agency and Russian intelligence staff officers enabled by human proxies 10 years ago in the 2016 election in the US or Brexit for the UK, now you have cognitive warfare where they can write programs, they can go attack social media and amplify the voice 10,000 fold over. So that's the impact of cognitive warfare. The Chinese and the Russians are all over it. I think in many ways they're better at it than us because, of course, we live in law-abiding societies. We're restricted in carrying out covert action without authorities from our own government. We don't, and we can't make use of organized crime groups as readily as they can, you know, hacking for hire the way they do in both those countries. So I do think that in a sense they're ahead of us because they don't have the limits we do. They don't have the legal restrictions on offensive cyber operations, and they're taking full advantage. It's an area that I think is a very dangerous threat to our societies, an existential threat, the rise in cognitive AI and cognitive AI warfare. You know, when you start to think about it and you see numbers, there's a lot of debate, but somewhere between 20 to 40% from the experts I talk to of everything on the internet is now AI generated. What does that mean for our young generation? You know, what does it mean for, you know, kids on Instagram and TikTok and all these other platforms? How do they make the determination at all? What's reality and what's just, you know, what's being parodied as reality from our adversaries?
So. Yeah, and it's one thing if it's just, you know, a benign effort or at least a comparatively benign effort to get likes and clicks. It's another if it's part of a malign influence campaign conducted by adversarial intelligence services.
Yeah, John, and thank you, because that reminded me of a final point I want to make. What are they doing? I call it SVR politology. They train their officers. They've got thousands of officers in their active measures directorate, their information warfare directorate, and they study the issues that are most divisive in the United States. They look at abortion, LGBTQ, Black Lives Matter, and they don't care. There's no fundamental Russian view on it. They just care that it's emotional for Americans, and that's what they attack. That's what they go after with a vengeance. Fake personalities, groups, and otherwise getting Americans to fight one another. The more sensational, the better. So that's what they do. That's what they train on. That's their template that I outline in the book.
You know, most of this discussion has focused on the intelligence services under Putin, but Putin won't be there forever. What role do you envision for these services in a post-Putin Russia, both during and after any transition of power?
Yeah, so unfortunately, John, I view Putin's control over the society right now is as near and total and complete as it can be. Now, you know, nobody saw the Bolshevik Revolution happening when it did in 1917. So we can always hope. But I just don't see any fundamental basis for a democratic revolution or, you know, overthrow of Putin. And there's been a lot of rumors of that lately, mostly from the West. I think it's mostly wishful thinking, including possibly some intelligence services in Europe and otherwise that sort of leak these ideas. You know, it's popular for their leadership. It's nice when an intelligence service says, you know, we're going to predict a coup happening in the next 2 months. Well, if they're right, they look like geniuses. If they're wrong, then they just say, well, it was really hard to, it's a really tough prediction to make. I don't buy it. That's not the type of analysis, my experience with CIA, that we don't do that type of cheap analysis. I think there's zero chance of Putin being overthrown. Whoever replaces him is going to be a Putin-anointed successor. If something happens suddenly within Russia, the security services and the Siloviki, those strongmen, those KGB veterans like Alexander Bortnikov from the FSB, the head of the FSB, he's in control. According to the Russian constitution, yes, the prime minister will be acting president until election. Forget it. Bortnikov is in control. Okay, he owns the units. They're going to put down any dissent or any uprising, and there won't be any uprising. So it's going to be that elite circle of security service veterans who decide if anything would surprise them. But I don't think it's going to surprise them. Unfortunately, Putin's rumored poor health has always proven to be unfounded. He comes out, appears half naked on top of a tiger or something else like that to show the world just how macho he is. You know, so yeah.
Well, Sean, I'm cognizant of the time, so I think we're going to leave it there. I want to thank you for making time to join me because, you know, like I said, I know you've got a number of other commitments. And that's because, as I said at the outset, I think there's a widespread and genuine interest in the subject matter of your book. Again, it's called Tradecraft Tactics and Dirty Tricks, Russian Intelligence in Putin's Secret War. Kudos to you for writing it. And I also want to give a shout out to U.S. Naval Institute Press because, you know, it's just another in a long line of excellent books that they've published.
Thank you, John. It's an honor. Appreciate you mentioning Naval Institute Press. I'm honored to be with them for them publishing me. They are a nonprofit. So I know you have a lot of servicemen and women that listen to your podcast. I appreciate their service. Please consider the book. It benefits a good cause, the Naval Press. Naval Institute, and I think you'd enjoy it. It's an easy read. It's written for the general reader to spread the message and awareness about one of our most implacable adversaries, the Russian intelligence services. It was an honor, John. Thank you for having me.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing, if you aren't following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.